Meeting of the House Judiciary will now come to order. The time is now 1 p.m. on Friday, March 20th, 2026, and we are meeting in the Grunberg Room, Capitol Room 120. The following members are present. Representative Costello, Representative Vance, Representative Eichscheid, Representative Underwood, and myself, Representative Gray, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. I would like to recognize the staff supporting this meeting. Sophia Tenney from House Records, Kyla Tupo from the Juno LIO, and my committee aide, Dylan Hitchcock-Lopez. We have two items of business on today's agenda. HJR 23, Constitutional Amendment, Governor's Proposed Budget, and HB 367, Consumer Data Privacy Act. Our first item is to bring back HJR 23, Constitutional Amendment, Governor's Proposed Budget. At the last hearing, I set an amendment deadline on Wednesday, March 18th at 11:59 p.m. We received no amendments. It is my intent to adopt a committee substitute for HJR 23. But first, I would like to ask the sponsor if she has any additional comments on the resolution.
Chair Gray, thank you. Is this wrap up before?
No. This is just if any comments before we adopt the CS.
No, not at this time.
Okay.
I'll wait.
At ease. Do we have? Back on the record, do we have a motion at this time?
Mr. Chair, I move the committee substitute for HJR 23, Work Order 34-LS0747-N is in Nancy, be adopted as the committee's working document.
I'll object for the purpose of discussion, and I would like to invite Buddy Witt, staff to Representative Underwood, to the witness table to provide background on the committee's substitute and walk us through the changes.
Thank you, Chair Gray and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Buddy Witt, staff to Representative Underwood. Chairman and members, if you recall, on Monday, we had a very good discussion about this bill. And specifically, there was some, to my recollection, three differing opinions on the term available funds. So the effort in this CS that you have before us was to clarify that language. And in order to do that, we made a slight adjustment to the structure of the bill. So the committee substitute makes several targeted clarifications to strengthen both the structure and the intent of the resolution. First, it reorganizes the language so that the proposed balanced budget requirement is cleanly incorporated into Article 9, Section 12 of the Alaska Constitution as a new subsection. So what you will see in the committee substitute is that subsection A is unchanged from the language that is currently in the Constitution, and the amendment, it simply changes it to A and adds a subsection B now, where we have added the language that then clarifies what available funds means. So second, and most, that is the most substantive change. It clarifies what available funds means for the purposes of the governor's budget submission. The committee substitute explicitly excludes the constitutional budget reserve from that calculation. This ensures that the governor's initial budget proposal reflects a truly balanced operating plan based on ongoing revenues rather than relying on reserve draws, and clarifies the definition of available funds. And finally, as you'll see in Section 3 of the CS, it includes clear effective date language of January 1st, 2027, with the thought process being if this does go before the voters and the voters affirm that they would like to see this in the Constitution, the whoever that new executive is would then have from their election 1 year until the budget submittal to make this requirement happen. And Mr. Chair, that is the CS.
Thank you, Mr. Witt. Are there any questions about the CS from committee members?
Mr. Chair, if I may add one more piece. This is a very important piece. I meant to say this was a collaborative effort. So after the meeting, Ms. Marie Marks and Mr. Rob Carpenter, Ms. Wallace, all got together and collaboratively we worked together on this language, and they all agreed that this language does do what the bill is intending.
Thank you. Representative Vance?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I do have a question on subsection B. Line 3. Under this subsection, available fund balances do not include money in the budget reserve fund established under Section 17 of this article. That's easy. Or the income of the permanent fund, whether deposited in the general fund or another fund that exceeds the amount available for appropriation as authorized by law. So for clarification, that means that the proposed budget could not exceed the POMV limit? Is that a different way of saying it?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, thank you for the question. To add clarification, when you say authorized by law, it could be current law or it could be future law. It could be any change to the law, any restriction within law that is placed. We can't exceed that. So it is any structure that's put around use of funds that are restricted in law. That holds within the Constitution. So in other words, whether it be a restriction on the amount of money in law that can be taken through a POMV, or should it change and there's a different type of structure for any kind of fund within law that we structure in a way that the legislature or anyone else cannot overdraw from that, wherever it may be, if it's in law, that restriction comes over to this section and the governor is restricted from exceeding that draw is the way I read this. And I'm not sure if anyone from Ledge Legal is able to join us to add clarification to that. But in our discussions, that is my understanding of what that language effectively does.
Thank you for that. This is new language, the way that it was worded a little bit. And so I'm just wanting to make sure that we're
of course
very clear on that, because it's whether it's the CBR, the income of the permanent fund, whether it's deposited in the general fund or another fund, which could be considered, if it's the income, it could be in the ERA. They can't consider that. So there, it sounds like you're spelling out what the legislature would consider the untouchable, like the untouchable funds that we don't want the governor to be using to try to balance a budget. So I appreciate the clarity, just wanting to make sure that I'm understanding it the way it's written.
Thank you. I will note for the record that we were joined by Representative Mina and Representative Kopp at 1:02 p.m. Any other questions about the CS? Seeing no more questions, I will remove my objection. Seeing no objection, the committee substitute for HJR 23, work order 34-LS0747/N as in November has been adopted as the committee's working document. Are there any final questions or comments on this resolution?
I think it's a good resolution.
Thank you, Representative
Kopp.
thank you, Representative Kopp. I concur. I'm grateful to the sponsor for bringing this constitutional amendment forward. I think it makes sense that the governor should present a balanced budget that does not include our savings account. Thank you. Seeing no further questions or comments, do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, at this time I move that House Joint Resolution 23, Work Order 34-LS0747/N be reported out of the Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Hearing no objection, House Joint Resolution 23, Work Order 34-LS0747/N is reported out of the Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. I authorize Legislative Legal Services to make any necessary technical and conforming changes. We will now take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork and transition to our next bill. Back on the record, our second item of business is to bring up House Bill 367, Consumer Data Privacy Act, up for its first hearing. At this time, I would like to invite the sponsor, Representative Story, and her staff, Kaylee Holm, to the witness table to introduce the bill. Representative Story, please put yourself on the record and begin your remarks.
Good afternoon, Chair Gray and members of the Judiciary Committee. It's good to be here today. For the record, I am Representative Andy Story, and I have the privilege of serving District 3 here in North Juneau, Fritz Cove, Auk Bay, Out the Road, Haines, Skagway, Kluckwan, and Gustavus. Before I begin, I do want to mention that I will need to briefly step out of our hearing this morning because I have a bill up at House Finance at 1:30. So my apologies, but Ms. Holmes will be here and our invited testifiers. And I will come back as quickly as I can. I am here today to introduce House Bill 367, the Consumer Personal Information Privacy Act. House Bill 367 is intended to modernize Alaska's law for today's digital economy by giving Alaskans meaningful control over their personal data. It sets clear standards for how businesses collect, use, sell, and share personal information, and it creates accountability when those standards are violated. I have many reasons for sponsoring this bill. First, a constituent reached out and shared their concerns that Alaskans did not have certain rights to protect their personal information digitally like many other states. Second, as I started looking into the depth and breadth of the consumer data broker industry, I realized I could not, in good conscience, ignore the very real harm the digital data broker industry can cause to our children, our elders, and anyone participating in modern digital life. And without sensible safeguards and meaningful oversight in what is now a largely unregulated system, those risks are continuing to grow. I learned that many companies collect children's data not just for tracking clicks. They are shaping attention and treating a child as someone to be nurtured, but as a data point to be measured, predicted, and manipulated. I learned that the same data market is also fueling fraud, especially against older Alaskans and other vulnerable populations. The more personal information that is bought and sold, the easier it is for bad actors to build a convincing lie. When scammers can buy lists showing someone's age, income, address, family connections, health interests, or buying habits, they can tailor a scam so precisely that it feels real. And the losses are staggering. The Congressional Joint Economic Committee estimates that identity theft connected to just four major data broker breaches in recent years has cost U.S. consumers more than $20 billion. I also learned that people are trying to escape abusive relationships are often unable to fully protect themselves because they do not know what apps are tracking them, how to turn those settings off, or whether they even can. A connected car, a phone app, or a smart device can become a tool of power and control. A woman trying to disappear for her own safety may never truly get away if we allow her personal information and location to be exposed. And finally, like you, Chair Gray, and members of the committee, I've heard from several constituents concerned about Alaska's unredacted voting rolls being shared. But the reality is that most likely this information, along with thousands of other personal and sensitive data points, was already available in the digital marketplace and can be bought and sold online at low cost by anyone willing to pay. That is why I am here before you today asking for your partnership in moving forward with legislation that gives individuals meaningful control over their personal data. And with that, Chair Cray, I would like to pass the mic to our expert witness, Matt Schultz, a policy analyst with expertise in technology and privacy at Consumer Reports. He can speak in more detail about the current data broker industry, how personal data is collected, why it's collected, the risks that it creates, and how the majority of other states have chosen to address this issue through public policy. And then I will ask my office staff, Kaylee Holm. She, she was going to present a PowerPoint, but I think we're having technical difficulty. But in your packet, there is that PowerPoint information, and we can go over that and cover the sectional analysis. So with that, I would like to turn this over to our invited testifier.
Thank you, Representative Story. Mr. Schwartz, welcome to House Judiciary. Please take yourself off mute, put yourself on the record, and begin your remarks.
Chair Gray, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me to testify today. For the record, my name is Matt Schwartz, and I'm a senior policy analyst with Consumer Reports based in Washington, D.C. Consumer Reports is an independent, nonprofit, and nonpartisan organization that works with consumers to create a fair and just marketplace. CR has 6 million members spread across every state in the U.S., including Alaska. So you might ask, why does CR have an interest in privacy legislation? I thought you guys were just a magazine that reviews cars and refrigerators. Well, it turns out that privacy is actually one of the most important issues for CR members. When we polled our members about all the different issues that we work on, product safety, food safety, cars, digital privacy rights actually came out on top. And privacy has been incorporated into our product ratings for a while now. We know it's one of the key metrics that people choose products on these days. And unfortunately, one of the key findings in the course of our product testing and other investigations is just how common it is for personal data to be misused across different industries, whether that's gym equipment, mental health apps, or even cars. So as we all know, we're living in an increasingly connected world. Many of the tools that we rely on every day, like our phones or other devices, are collecting data every second of the day. Because of ubiquitous tracking technologies like cookies, pixels, beacons, our devices and the apps and websites on them know where we go, know who we talk to, what we browse on the internet, and loads more. That can be very helpful in many cases. Many of us are now reliant on tools like GPS turn-by-turn directions or on platforms like this one to connect from afar. But the technology that brings with it a lot of modern conveniences can also lead to issues when consumers lack knowledge or control about how their personal data is used. And so how does this play out in practice, and why is it a problem for consumers? I'll provide 3 quick examples that illustrate why lawmakers around the country have become increasingly interested in creating stronger guardrails around data collection and use. The first story comes from a New York Times report around a year ago or so that found that major car companies like GM and Ford were secretly collecting and sharing people's driving behavior. That included how hard they brake, how fast they accelerated, and their precise location data. And they were sharing that information with marketers. Those marketers then shared that information with insurance companies. In some cases, those insurance companies then increased people's premiums based off of this information that consumers never even knew they had allowed their car company to share. No one should have to pay more because a third-party marketing company secretly collected and shared their information. But that's exactly what happened. The second example is about the ubiquitous sale of our location data. There's a whole marketplace of third-party businesses called data brokers that specialize in collecting and selling thousands of data points about us. This information is collected from the GPS trackers on our phones, and it includes visits to sensitive locations like health facilities, political rallies, houses of worship, and more. This information is collected and shared as often as every 3 seconds. It doesn't then take a huge leap to understand how this information being available to anyone with a credit card can put people at risk and enable stalkers and others to track people down. It's also important to understand how even more run-of-the-mill data broker activities can put consumers at risk. Data brokers use their digital dossiers on consumers to make incredibly invasive inferences or guesses about them. Data brokers sell lists of consumers sorted into categories like rural and barely making it, or credit-crunched city families. In one recent story, a data broker was selling lists of people battling Alzheimer's disease. These lists are a goldmine for payday lenders, scammers, and other third parties that wish to target particularly susceptible consumers for scammy financial products. Finally, there's the increasing risk that companies can use all of this information that they've collected about us over the years to set individualized prices for products and services that we rely on. The worst fear is that businesses will find a way to charge any given consumer their maximum willingness to pay for any given item based off of this information. Recently, CR co-authored an investigation on the grocery delivery app Instacart that found that Instacart had placed consumers into one of several pricing buckets that resulted in consumers paying different prices for the same grocery items that were purchased at the exact same time from the exact same stores. Instacart wasn't necessarily using personal data to sort consumers into these pricing buckets, but the fear is that their pricing experimentation is just the first step in that direction. Other grocery stores are experimenting with facial recognition technology that could also pave the way towards personalized pricing. So it's for these reasons that many states have taken action to pass comprehensive privacy laws. Since Alaska first started considering this issue back in 2020, 2021, 20 states have passed comprehensive privacy laws. Among these laws, there's a variety of approaches, though many share at least some common DNA amongst them. For example, all of these laws include the same consumer rights, same set of consumer rights, such as the right to opt out of sales or targeted advertising, a right to correct personal information, a right to delete personal information, a right to access that information, and a right to a portable copy of it. Almost all of the laws also set requirements for things like the content of privacy policies, the treatment of especially sensitive data, and the requirement for businesses to assess the level of risk that their data processing creates. It appears that the intent of HB 367 is to join these states in terms of the basic protections it offers, while also taking a strong stand when it comes to sensitive data and affirmative obligations on businesses to limit their data collection to only that which is necessary to provide the requested product or service. Now, in general, a common motif that you'll hear, especially from the industries regulated by this type of legislation, is that standardization is paramount. Companies that are subject to these laws typically prefer that they look as similar to those as passed by other states as possible in order to ease the path to compliance. Of course, making compliance simple for businesses is certainly a very valid goal, and it does create other benefits as well, such as making it easier for the Attorney General to partner with other state enforcers in their oversight of the law. However, it's also important to know that there's been a trend towards divergence among state privacy laws over the last couple of years. For example, several states that originally passed almost identical laws between 2021 and 2024 have already returned to amend those laws to increase protections in certain areas. Some common themes of those changes include stronger rules around kids' data, stronger rules around geolocation information and other sensitive data, narrowing the exemptions for certain industries like financial institutions and healthcare, and making the consumer rights in the bill more usable in practice. As a result, there's now something of a menu of options for legislators to choose from in terms of which areas of the law to pay special attention to. From CR's perspective, there's two particular provisions to ensure that are strong in privacy laws. The first is the treatment of sensitive data, where we've advocated for a straight ban on the sale of sensitive data, and barring that, at least a ban on special categories of sensitive information from being sold, like precise geolocation data. Several states now have those protections in place, and it appears like HB 367 is interested in this topic as well. And then the second provision is something called data minimization. This is the idea I alluded to earlier, that companies should really only be collecting and using the data they need to provide you with the service that you asked for. The flashlight app on your phone doesn't need access to location information and shouldn't be asking consumers to consent to it. A couple of states have passed or are considering protections along these lines. So overall, I would say that the experience of data privacy legislation has been that this is an area that cannot be simply one and done. The technology moves really fast, and therefore any approach should be flexible and allow for improvements over time. I take this to be the intent of HB 367, and I know that Kaylee is going to explain the bill in further detail in just a second. So thanks again for inviting me, and I welcome any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Schwartz. So when you talked about 21 states having passed similar legislation, are we seeing in the states that have passed this sort of legislation that they're successful? Are they actually banning sales on sensitive data? Do we know that sensitive data is not being sold from those states? Do we know that there are limits on your flashlight having access to other data? Like, how successful are state laws mm-hmm. like this at accomplishing their goals?
I think improvements are being made, but I think there's still a long way to go, frankly speaking. And one of the kind of only ways that we have to kind of measure that is through the enforcement actions that we're seeing. In all of these cases, it's only the Attorney General that has enforcement authority over these bills. And so while we have seen maybe a handful of enforcement actions over the last couple of years, kind of affirmatively requiring businesses to change their practices, it hasn't been a ton. And, you know, CR has measured compliance with a few key provisions in state privacy laws. And we do see that it's relatively common to still find kind of facial violations of these provisions. So, for example, one of the consumer rights that I talked about is this right to opt out. You can actually test that by opting out of a company selling your information and then seeing if they basically target you with targeted advertising on the next couple of sites. And it was relatively easy for us to find that those opt-outs weren't working in practice. And so that's something that we've, you know, raised to the enforcers in those states that, hey, look, it's pretty easy to find violations. We hope that you guys can shore that up over time. And so I think it's mixed evidence. I would say that is good evidence for having really strong enforcement mechanisms. I know private right of action is a very controversial idea, but that would help companies have the incentive to comply a little bit more affirmatively than attorney general's offices, which typically don't have that much enforcement capability.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Schwartz? Representative Vance.
You can call on other people before me. I always have questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a question for invited testimony. Thank you. Thank you for the sponsor of the bill bringing this forward. I've seen some of the documentaries that were referred to. And the question that I have is, have other states pursued a civil right of action and on these privacy, data privacy sharing, and has that been effective?
No, they haven't. The only state that has a private right of action is California, and it's quite limited. It only applies to in instances of a data breach where a consumer suffered financial harm. In that case, in California, a consumer can bring a case. In all other instances, in all other 20 states, it's just AG enforcement only.
Follow up?
Permission to dialogue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions on just the effectiveness. Most of the time, people don't know that their data is being shared or sold. So I have a couple of questions on how we could go about that. Is it legally possible? Have other states pursued a prohibition on selling personal consumer data?
No state has gone as far as to blanket ban the selling of any personal data. What some states have done, including Maryland and Oregon and Virginia, is ban the sale of certain categories of especially sensitive information. And so in Maryland, you can't sell any sensitive information. That includes information about your health, demographic information, geolocation, and a few other categories. In Oregon, you can't sell someone's geolocation information. And Virginia passed a similar bill that's waiting to be signed by the governor to do the same thing. So we haven't seen a complete blanket ban, but we have seen targeted versions of that in a couple of places.
Thank you. One more question, and it's regarding the data broker registration. At the beginning of the hearing, I'm thinking, what is a data broker? But I think it's all very self-explanatory now. But do you think that if they had to do an annual report on the data that was sold and shared and disclosed that they conducted that, if would that create an accountability and kind of a notice to consumers of their activity? Do you think that that would slow down some of or increase data protection for people?
I think if coupled with a substantive consumer right to delete that information from data brokers or exercise some control over it, that is something that would increase accountability. A couple of states have considered an idea of a data broker registry, and I think this is an element of 367, and it's going to be spoken about in a couple of minutes. And that is basically the idea that you're talking about. And so data brokers usually defined as a business that collects and sells information of a consumer with which it doesn't have a direct relationship. All the businesses that qualify as that in the state have to register. And so they have to register usually with the Secretary of State or the Attorney General's office, and they have to pay an annual fee, and they have to disclose some information about their activities, including whether they've collected kids data or geolocation information, they're doing business as name, and so on and so forth. And I think the concept of that is to shine a light on this industry that a lot of people have no idea about whatsoever. Like the names of these companies are not household names. They're names that consumers have never heard before. So that is the idea of a data broker registry. And I think that's a good first step, but I also think that consumers should have rights over that information ultimately as well. Again, consumers had no choice in these companies collecting their information. And so I think at a minimum, they ought to be able to delete it from these companies with certain carve outs, of course.
Awesome. Thank you.
Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, Mr. Schwartz, thank you for this very interesting testimony you're giving me us today. I've never heard of a data broker before now, and I'm thinking now all those privacy notices I get from financial institutions and such, I should probably actually look at those. And I'm a person that generally reads the fine print. But the question I have is, you were talking about data breaches of our data that data brokers have. And one of the things that I think I've learned is oftentimes the time lag between when a data breach happens and when the affected individuals whose data was stolen is quite long. So can you give us a sense of the range, time ranges or average time it takes before a victim of a data breach, my personal data, before I'm actually informed that my data has been stolen?
That's something I don't know exactly off the top of my head. I know all 50 states have data breach notification standards at this point, and the timeline for when consumers need to be notified varies. I think it's a matter of weeks often, but some states are more stringent than others. Some states require that you notify law enforcement first so that they can conduct an investigation, because sometimes it's better not to reveal a breach to a consumer if it's going to endanger the actual investigation of who collected this information. So it varies. Different states have different views on that. I don't know what the standard is in Alaska off the top of my head, but I take your point that it often is too late for it to be actionable for the consumer and for them to protect themselves.
Follow up. Thank you for that. And then I guess the second question is if my private data has value, monetary value, why don't I, as the originator of that data, why don't I get a certain percentage of that financially?
Yeah, I mean, it's an idea that a couple of states have considered. It's not something, to be honest, that Consumer Reports has supported, just because there's an idea that if data becomes a commodity, then people who are going to be more likely to trade in on that commodity are people of lesser means, frankly. And so you might end up creating a two-tiered system where, you know, frankly, poorer folks are more willing to trade in the value of their money to get a couple bucks at the end of the month, where richer folks might not want to make that trade-off. In our view, privacy should just be protected for everybody. But I get your point. Like, there is a lot of value to this information that's being exploited by businesses, and you don't have a say in it. And I get why that would be frustrating for people.
Yeah. Thank you for that nuance. That makes perfect sense to me. So thank you for that.
Thank you. At this time, thank you so much, Mr. Schwartz. At this time, we'll have Ms. Holm walk us through the sectional analysis.
Thank you. For the record, Kaylee Holm, staff to Representative Andy Story. And if I may, before I go into the sectional analysis, I would just like to highlight the main key points of this bill. And then if we want a deeper dive into like each line section, I am more than happy to do it. One of the strong points that we want to make is the state of Alaska already has a constitutional right to privacy. It's Article 1, Section 22. So in theory, we should already be protecting people's data, and it just might not – the rules just haven't quite caught up with that. Matt went over the data broker markets. I just like to emphasize how much it actually is worth. Like right now, it's almost a $300 billion industry, and it's projected to grow over a $500 billion industry in 10 years. So there is money in this area, and there is a lot of people interested in it. So the key components of this bill are the rights of consumers, business obligations, the special protections for minors, the data broker registry, and the idea of creating some transparency, enforcement and accountability, revenue, and then I always just like to highlight this because we are inserting an act. A large portion of this bill is the definitions, and the definitions really mean something when you're looking at what is allowed and what isn't, what is carved out, who this bill is actually being applied to. So the first thing I just want to start out before we get any deeper is who this bill doesn't apply to. And so we wanted to make sure that we didn't put any unmanageable burden on smaller businesses. So this bill right now, and you're seeing this change in other states, but this is the higher threshold right now, you have to have over 100,000 customers and over 50% of your revenue is coming from selling data or sharing data. So other than that, anything smaller than that, this bill will not apply to protecting smaller businesses. So what next is the rights of consumers. So the rights of consumers, you have the right to know that your data is being collected. You have the right to know what is being collected. You have the right to delete your data once it has been collected. And you have the right to opt out. And I can go into further detail of those if you're interested. And then the next part is what is required of a business. So the business has to clearly notify you that your data is being collected. It has to maintain a privacy policy that is easy to find, easy to read, and not hidden. So it has to be clear and conspicuous. They have to keep records in order to comply with the ability to delete. So knowing who they then in turn sold your data to, what categories of your data was shared, so that if you request it to be deleted, it's not only deleted at the business in which you engaged in, but also the third party or the data broker in which purchased it. And then there is a limit of collection to what is reasonably necessary for a business to provide for the service that the consumer has requested. So he gave a great example of your flashlight does not need to know where you're located. Another great one is that you see all over the news is the Weather Channel. Comes on everybody's app automatically. Doesn't need to be collecting your data beyond knowing what the weather is. So the next section that I want to talk about is minors. So this is a very important section for the representative. And it's a special carve out. So for minors, and this is for 16 and under, and we would actually be interested in maybe increasing this depending on how this process goes, is a business. Sorry, I have lost my spot in the line. So essentially, you cannot sell data of somebody 16 or under. You cannot profile them and target them for information. So a much, much stronger than just being able to opt out. It totally does that band on selling, sailing. And then finally, we've already had a little bit of a conversation on the data broker registry. So this again is an idea to bring up transparency. A lot of people maybe have never heard of Snowflake or these other companies that are collecting your data. And if you don't know about them, there's no way that you can pay attention to what they're doing. So this just encourages transparency. It also adds, we add a registration fee with the effort to make sure that these costs are not getting put onto the state, especially since of the amount of revenue that they are making from these. Some enforcement and accountability. Enforcement would be done by the Department of Law and the Attorney General. We do not have a right to private action written in this bill. Again, another decision point to be discussed. And then we establish a separate consumer policy account that a business. So something that's really important to note is data brokers cannot have, in the definition, are not first point of engagement. They're always third party. And first point of engagement can be anything like an app on your phone. So if the app is on your phone, they are no longer a data broker, even if they are the ones collecting the largest amount of your data before selling it. So this then targets those businesses that aren't data brokers because they're first point of interaction, a 3% fee on the revenue in which they make off of selling and sharing data. I already mentioned the definitions. And then finally, Matt had mentioned like one of the important things to make this bill able to increase enforceability and compliance is to match a more state's national standard. And so when this bill was originally written and started to be drafted in 2021, there was no industry standard. There was only one state that even had passed a consumer personal data privacy bill. And since then, as he mentioned, over 20 have, and 15 more are currently working on one. And it was the choice of the representative because the original bill had gone through so many committees already, and there was already a lot of work on it. We wanted to use that as a starting point, but we are understanding now potentially that we might want to get more in line, keeping all the intent the same, and just moving more towards something that can be more in compliance. So there was a few more recommendations that we have that aren't currently in the bill for consideration, which would be a lot of things that Matt highlighted of a special call out for sensitive data, which is not currently in the bill. A special call out for biometric data, which is not currently in the bill, and then just an update of aligning, again, keeping the intent, but aligning of a more industry standard. And with that, I can take questions or I can go into a sectional analysis.
Thank you. I think we will want a sectional analysis. Okay. Not today.
Okay.
At some point in this committee. Yeah, at some enough. Point in this committee, but just, I don't think we're ready for the full sectional analysis and detail mm-hmm. today. So I think if it's okay, we'll do some questions now and then we'll go to public testimony.
Okay.
I have a question to start off with. Mm-hmm. The businesses with more than 100,000 customers. Does that mean like more than 100,000 Alaskan customers?
Right. So these are only business. This is only for businesses operating in Alaska. So the assumption would be yes.
So my question is about that 100,000 number. That's like a seventh of the population. If you applied that same fraction to Texas or California, it would require over 5 million mm-hmm. customers. I'm just curious about the 100,000 number and how that is if that's the right number for Alaska. How did you come up with that number?
Through the chair, that is a very good thing to focus on. That number we chose because it was the highest threshold. We felt that what's really important is to get some rights of privacy, control over privacy back to the individual. And we didn't want this bill stalled because it was overburdensome to small businesses. So what we chose was the industry standard, essentially, which is that large number. I will acknowledge most states use that number. And so you're focusing on more of these larger outside organizations that are coming in and purchasing the data without affecting smaller businesses. But I will acknowledge that there are a few states you're starting to see a trend to shrink that number to a more reasonable size based on population or on what size business is actually buying and selling and capturing your data.
My second question, then I'll open up to everybody else, is that I instinctively just react about the ban on selling folks under the age of 16 data. Like, why is it the age not 18? Why did you guys decide on age 16 and not age 18?
At the time of drafting this bill, it was because we were trying to keep a relative standard of what the representative was carrying other bills talking about the age of 16. And so it's 16 and under. And so we thought for consistency's sake, since then, it actually, there was a desire to start a conversation about what is the proper age, if it makes sense to be 17 and under instead. So a lot of nationally, or like for a federal law, they follow, it's 13. So this one is actually stricter, more strict as it is right now. But again, we're not tied exactly to these numbers if there needs to be a dialogue on what makes the most sense.
We'll do questions now and then we'll have public testimony. Representative Costello.
Thank you. So it's my understanding that the bill updates existing law on Social Security numbers. Could you explain what does that mean? What's the current law related to Social Security numbers and how is that updated? And then it mentions there are exemptions somehow. Could you talk more about that in relation to the Social Security numbers?
Yeah, so this bill is updating to create a different law for security numbers. It's more, I don't want to use the word conforming, but that's essentially what we're doing, is just saying there is currently a law for Social Security numbers, and this new act is not going to change that previous law. It's just written into the law itself. But I believe we do have legal on if they want to better explain that.
Yes, we have Ian Walsh from Legislative Legal. Would you like to refer your question to Mr. Walsh?
Well, I guess I would just like to know what specifically is the law about Social Security numbers, and then does the bill have exemptions for HIPAA and what have you?
Mr. Walsh.
For the record, this is Ian Walsh, Legislative Legal Services. I can answer the second part of Representative Costello's question, and I might ask her to rephrase the first part because I missed it. But the exemptions in the bill currently exempt basically HIPAA-covered entities, and it does that in two ways. So let me get the page and line numbers ready to point you to, just one moment here. Okay. Sorry, it's a long bill. Hold on just a moment. So the exemptions are starting related to HIPAA, start on page 13, line 23. So the provisions of the bill would not apply to protected health information that's collected by basically HIPAA-covered entities and business associates. And then if you look at the bottom of page 13, starting at line 30, it also exempts the covered entity if they are maintaining patient information in the same manner as medical information or protected health information. So the exemption in the A1 there, starting on line 23, is for protected health information. And then the in paragraph 2, it more broadly exempts the covered entity patient information if it's maintained in the same manner as the protected health information described in 1.
Thank you.
Do you want to repeat your first question for him, Representative Costello?
Well, there's just in some of the material that I've seen in reviewing this bill, there's something about the laws surrounding Social Security numbers, and that's what I'm trying to get at. What are the current laws surrounding Social Security numbers?
Mr. Walsh.
Through the chair to Representative Costello, I do not have an understanding of the exhaustive understanding of the current laws that govern Social Security numbers. There's a lot of them. There's like kind of a federal law overlay essentially over a lot of this, and it depends on the context. There are federal limitations on use of disclosure of Social Security numbers, but I would have to get back to you on the details of those federal laws. So I would be more than happy to analyze that in a memo or phone call for you in the future.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Kopp?
Sure. So I don't know if it's the bill sponsor or the gentleman online, but the separate written consent for geolocation data, I'm just trying to think of how that would work with the apps. You know, mostly there's an in-app consent that people have to consent to their location being tracked. And then I know the iPhone operating system is constantly warning us, do you want your data tracked across other apps? You know, yes or no. How do you envision this for consumer data in a digital sense when it says a separate written consent? Just wondering how that would be. Is that something you would envision being handled in a digitized format or in an actual, like download a document, sign it, and then scan and email it off? How would that work?
Ms. Holm?
Through the chair, I do not want to misspeak. My understanding is the what you're talking about right now, what you're currently seeing on your apps of Do Not Track is in response to these bills in the EU and other states. And instead of having two separate, it's just a widespread, you just now get that offer. I don't fully understand how we give a lot of flexibility and room for regulations to be written underneath about how exactly it is implemented. So I don't know if I can answer that correctly, but if there's someone else that wants to expand on what I just said.
Mr. Schwartz?
No, I think that's generally correct. I think the in-app consent notices for location information would satisfy this. I am looking at this, so this is section 4548.840. It does say the consent must be in writing. Maybe that's something that could be tweaked slightly if that's leads to a little bit of ambiguity. But yeah, to me it seems like the in-app notice would satisfy that insofar as it's the app requesting information for non-apps or websites or other businesses that want to collect geolocation information, then they'd need to find some other way of notifying consumers and getting their consent, whether that's through a separate privacy notice, a pop-up, or otherwise.
Thank you. At this time, I would like to open public testimony on House Bill 367. Public testimony on House Bill 367 is now open. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify on House Bill 367? Please come forward, state your name for the record, and begin your testimony.
too this time.
Hello, I'm Jane Smith from Juneau, and I thought there was a good discussion here on generally what we're trying to do with the privacy bill. I thought to talk a little about how it's affected me personally, having that lack of control over privacy. And I'd start with a little history. Back in the 70s in the military, pre-web, they had us put our social security numbers on our duffel bags going through the airport because people may have the same name. And indeed, I ran into that situation a time or two. Obviously, we don't do that anymore. Then in the 80s, Alaska actually passed a law to allow us to go to our phone company and tell them, take the address off the phone number, just have the phone number, and not have to pay an extra charge for that. I took advantage of that. And then, again, in the early 90s, free web, stationed in a military base for several months, and they issued a library card with my social security number on. Again, we don't do that anymore. I want to tell you, nowadays, I've done some searching on the web for me and found these data brokers. They put my address, they put my date of birth, they put relatives who are not my relatives on there, all kinds of misinformation, and you don't even have to pay for that. And the date of birth is something that I consider personally identifiable information. And I maybe can go to the Social Security Administration and get a new Social Security number, but how in the world am I going to get a different birth date? So we do need controls. I, at one point, had applied for credit, and they came back at me and said, hey, Miss Smith, we need to talk to you. So got me on the phone. They started asking you questions, trying to find out, are you really who you say you are? Well, they asked me, could I give the approximate age of Steve Smith? I don't know a Steve Smith. Do you know the approximate age of Nancy Smith? I don't know a Nancy Smith. Well, Miss Smith, we're going to have to deny you credit, and you can apply for a free credit report, which came out very clean. And that's when I first started learning about data brokers, because I was really worried. Is my identity stolen? And started finding out a bunch of these data brokers, again, listing these people as my relatives. All because at some point, apparently, they lived on the same street I had lived on at some point. So I had no way to go back and correct it, do anything about it. Another one, I had gone to get one of my free credit reports. And again, the old scenario, trying to make sure I am who I say I am. By now, it's automated a bit, and they're sending you through a line of questions. And one of them wanted to know, give me a list of street addresses and said, which one did I live at in this particular town? That address that I had lived at was the summer of 1970, over 50 years ago. I did not remember what in the world street I'd lived on for just a few months. And of course, I apparently got the question wrong. And again, I wouldn't know which of the hundreds of data brokers provided this to the credit bureau. The credit bureaus are using this and abusing us to a degree. Basically, And I would hope they're putting addresses, phone numbers, you name it out there. And again, you don't even have to pay to see this. They're basically doxing us. And in a sense, they're stalking us when they go and try to find out, well, where did you live 50 years ago? I I think I'll just end with saying, I know this proposed law might not be perfect, and like all laws, it can be amended, but I think it's a big, big, good step in the right direction, and I heartily support it with whatever amendments you might come up with now and in the future to try to keep up with this technology. And thank you for giving me the time to speak.
Thank you, Ms. Smith, for your testimony. We'll now go to Becca Stern online in Anchorage. Please take yourself off mute and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Gray and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Becca Stern, and I'm a legislative policy fellow for the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska. Our organization protects and advances the civil rights and individual liberties enshrined in the U.S. and Alaska constitutions, including the right to privacy. We thank Representative Story's office for introducing this bill and this committee for hearing it. We are very concerned about how commercial entities jeopardize this right to privacy by collecting, processing, storing, disclosing, buying and selling unprecedented quantities of personal information about every one of us. They do so with no real restrictions and little to no meaningful consent or even awareness required before using it for their own profit. In order for this consumer privacy legislation to be effective for Alaskans, we suggest the following key provisions. First, the state must establish data minimization rules so that companies only collect, store, and process Alaskans' information in ways that are reasonably necessary to provide the products or services the consumer asks for. There is currently a loophole in almost all states' data privacy laws that allows companies to collect data beyond what is reasonably necessary if they state so in privacy policies, which are often lengthy, complex, and go unread by consumers. Closing that loophole is essential to limiting excessive and exploitative data collection. For example, when I select that a weather app can use my location when I'm in the app to check the forecast, I would not reasonably expect that the app would sell my precise geolocation data to third parties for target marketing and analysis for hedge funds, purposes entirely unrelated to weather. Data minimization is a pillar of privacy protection, and we see it as an essential element for consumer privacy legislation to be effective. HB 367 would be improved by closing this loophole, found in the proposed new AS 48805A and C on page 5 of the bill. The second critical provision is banning the sale or unnecessary use of Alaskan sensitive data, including precise geolocation, health data, and data about minors. This provision should also include an affirmative opt-in consent requirement when a company shares that data with another entity, giving consumers power over how their sensitive data can be shared before it is shared. This higher privacy standard is critical to prevent some of the most serious and dangerous harms to consumers, such as data brokers selling the addresses of domestic violence survivors to their abusers. We appreciate the attention paid in this bill to the data of minors, but would like to see sensitive data protected for all Alaskans. A third provision that is essential for effective consumer privacy legislation is establishing a private right of action, giving Alaskans the ability to file a civil lawsuit themselves when their rights have been violated, instead of relying on state attorneys general with limited capacity and resources. Strong enforcement is necessary for privacy legislation to be effective, and a private right of action provides a financial incentive for companies to act responsibly. We support including a private right of action in HB 367. These pieces are critical, but we've seen other important elements that are often included in privacy bills in other states that would bolster privacy rights for Alaskans. First is including civil rights protections, so companies can't use personal data in a discriminatory manner. Second is banning manipulative design and unfair marketing, which intentionally trick consumers into sharing more data than they intend to. Third is guaranteeing individual consumer rights, including the rights to request the deletion of personal data, to know which third parties their data has been disclosed to, and to control how their personal information is sold and shared. The bill does not currently include civil rights protections, but does include restrictions on manipulative design found in the definition of consent on page 26 and the establishment of individual consumer rights throughout section 4. On a personal note, I'd like to share that I recently found that 356 pieces of my personal information were available across 47 listings tied to my identity, including my name, current and past addresses, family members, marital status, and contact information. In some cases, this information was available for free or just a few dollars. All Alaskans deserve real data protections, and enforcement mechanisms to assert their privacy over their personal information. We look forward to providing further feedback on this legislation and working to ensure Alaskans' privacy rights and information are protected. We will submit an official letter for the record to provide more in-depth analysis and any additional recommendations. Thank you for this opportunity to testify and for hearing this legislation.
Thank you, Ms. Stern. We'll now go to Chris Quigley in Sacramento, California.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Quigley with the Consumer Data Industry Association to testify in respectful opposition to House Bill 367. CDIA's members include credit bureaus, data brokers, and background check companies. HB 367 has many problems that I would like to address. First, the bill's exceptions for federal frameworks such as the FCRA, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, are limited and unclear. The exemptions offered at the data level rather than the entity level, meaning the same company may be subject to entirely different regulatory obligations depending on how data is used at a given moment. This creates overlapping and potentially conflicting requirements, particularly where federal law already imposes strict standards for accuracy, dispute resolution, and permissible use of consumer information. Without clearer alignment, the bill risks undermining the uniform national system established under federal law. Second, HB 367 introduces consumer rights, such as deletion and opt-out, that may conflict with legal obligations to maintain accurate and complete records. Data used for identity verification, fraud prevention, and employment screening, as well as tenant screening, must be reliable and consistent. Requiring deletion or restricting use of this data without appropriate safeguards can reduce data accuracy and impact both consumers and businesses negatively. Third, the bill's treatment of publicly available information is unclear and potentially too narrow. Many important services rely on public records, including court filings, property records, and professional licenses. If these data sources are inadvertently restricted, the bill could disrupt lawful transparency-enhancing activities that are widely relied upon. Finally, the data broker registration requirement would impose new administrative burdens and create a publicly accessible registry that may expose companies without providing meaningful additional consumer protections. These requirements could disproportionately impact smaller entities and reduce competition. For these reasons, we respectfully urge the committee to oppose HB 367. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Quigley, for your testimony. Seeing no further testifiers online, are there any other testifiers in the room? Seeing no one else in the room or online, public testimony on House Bill 367 is now closed. Are there any final questions for the sponsor on House Bill 367? And welcome back, Representative Story. Any final questions for the sponsor on House Bill 367? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about how the bill currently doesn't include the protections for sharing biometric data. But when I think about data that is being shared, that is something that is a huge concern of me. And I know that there are a lot of companies out there that are utilizing health data that we're using on apps on our phones, et cetera. So I was wondering if either you or perhaps the invited testimony could talk more about where biometric data could potentially fit into this bill.
Ms. Holm or Representative Story?
For the record, Kaylee Holm, staff to Andy Story, Representative Andy Story, excuse me. So right now we have definitions for biometric data and we have definitions for sensitive data. It is currently called out because when we originally wrote this this bill was originally written, there are current laws in state statute talking about biometric data. However, they are more limited and probably need to be expanded based on what is now collected. So how I see a potential for inserting it into this bill is creating, as a few of the public testifiers and the invited testimony have mentioned, is a special section for sensitive data, which includes biometric data, and then making the exemptions more similar to what you see for the geolocation data.
Thank you.
Other questions? Seeing no additional questions at this time, thank you so much for your presentation today. We will put House Bill 367 aside and bring it up at a later date. Before we wrap up, I would like to set an amendment deadline for House Bill 298, Legislative Ethics Committee and Proceedings, for Wednesday, March 25th, 2026 at 11:59 p.m. Please work with my committee aide to ensure that your amendments are submitted on time. That concludes today's business before the committee. Before we adjourn, here's a preview of next week's meetings. Monday, consideration of governor's appointees to Commission on Judicial Conduct, Violent Crimes Compensation Board, and Alaska Police Standards Council. On Wednesday, we will have consideration of governor's appointee to the State Commission for Human Rights. We will also have first hearing for House Bill 308, Blood, Breath, Alcohol Content Limits, sponsored by myself. HB 324, Virtual Currency Kiosks, sponsored by Representative Moore. And House Bill 136, Railroad Utility Corridors, by Representative Kopp. On Friday, we will hear House Bill 298 again, Legislative Ethics Committee and Proceedings, sponsored by Representative Galvin. House Bill 242 in its first hearing in this committee, Sexual Assault by Healthcare Workers, sponsored by Representative Hannon. House Bill 189, Criminal Conviction Overturned, Receive, Pass PFD, by Representative Mears. And please note that we have previously said that we would hear HDR 31, Constitutional Amendment, Corporations and Rights, but it will not be heard due to a scheduling conflict with the resolution sponsor. We will bring back HD 31 sometime later. The time is now 2:13 p.m., and this hearing of the House Judiciary Committee is adjourned.